The first attempts to analyze thinking systematically start with Aristotle, around 350 BCE. Aristotle's logic was the gold standard through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, indeed until about 150 years ago. In this lecture and the next, I want to concentrate on the logic of Aristotle. That will serve as a link between what we've discussed so far and what we're working toward. What we've emphasized so far are techniques for logical thinking, with visualization as an important component. Aristotle himself lays out his logic using a visualization, that takes up concepts and propositions right where we left off. What we're working toward is an understanding of the flow of rational argument. Aristotle's a major step in that direction. Later on, I'll have you put that understanding to work, analyzing arguments in the great debate. Let me start with a little history. The genealogy of Greek philosophy runs from Socrates to Plato to Aristotle. That transition of great minds is also a transition from oral to written culture. Socrates wrote nothing down. Indeed, he insisted that writing things down negatively impacts our capacity for memory and even for wisdom. Plato came next, transmitting the Socratic tradition to us in the halfway house of theater. Plato made Socrates a character in the plays we know as dialogues. In Plato's theatrical performances, an actor spoke as Socrates and indeed spoke against writing things down, but the plays themselves were written. Aristotle studied with Plato for 20 years. He produced a range of popular works, including dialogues, the exoteric works, but none of those survive. The Aristotle we know is a scholarly writer, a writer of discursive treatises. Those are Aristotle's esoteric works, based on lecture notes, either his own notes or his students, or some combination of the two. He wrote on physics, astronomy, biology, the soul, and logic. I want you to try to visualize Aristotle. What did he look like? We know he had small eyes and spindly legs. The earliest visual representations show him bearded and balding. We know he either stammered or spoke with a lisp. I also want you to try to visualize the texts we're dealing with. Papyrus rolls, written in Greek, containing all the logic of Aristotle. I'll talk about the history of those texts a little later in the lecture. Aristotle is credited with the invention of logic. At the core of his logic, indeed of all logic, is this breathtaking idea. Maybe we can systematize thought. One of our greatest sources of power is our ability to think. But there are problems with thinking. It's often difficult, and it often seems to go only so far. But if we could systematize thought, we could perhaps make it less difficult. If we could formalize thought, we might be able to do the same amount of thinking with, well, with less thinking. If we could schematize thought, we might be able to make our thinking faster and more accurate and more effective. That attempt to systematize thought starts with Aristotle. There are some ideas I think that I could have had if I'd been at the right place at the right time. Maybe this is just conceit, but if I had been at the right place at the right time, I think I could have come up with the internal combustion engine. The mechanical elements were there in the steam engine: expansion in pistons, regulation by valves. The chemical elements were there in the combustion of petroleum. The internal combustion engine, that seems like an idea that I might have had. But there are some ideas that I think I would never have had. One of those is the very idea of logic. For that, we needed an Aristotle. Aristotle's work remains the core of logic all the way through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. At some point, Kant says that logic, and he means Aristotelian logic, is a perfected science in which no more progress can be made. That was at the beginning of the 19th century. Like all such predictions, it turned out to be wrong. By the end of the 19th century, we get the beginnings of what we consider contemporary logic, and the 20th was one of the great centuries in the history of logic. The computer age is grounded in logic. The idea of formalizing, systematizing, even of mechanizing thought stretches as one unbroken chain from Aristotle to the logic that drives your laptop. So let me give you the fundamentals of Aristotle's logic. A few lectures ago, we talked about concepts or categories, the atoms of thought. We used Venn diagrams to visualize our two categories, how they link together into what are called categorical propositions. Let me remind you. The categorical proposition, "No frogs are philosophers," looks like this. The proposition tells us that no frogs are philosophers. There's no overlap. Nothing is both a frog and a philosopher. So that middle area is empty. We black it out. All neurologists are MDs. There aren't any neurologists that aren't in the overlap. So we black out that left area. No neurologists over there. Some laws are unjust. For this, we used an X to indicate that there is something in the overlap. Finally, some inventions are not patentable. We use an X over the inventions area, outside of the patentable area, to indicate that some inventions are not patentable. Logic is about structure. Aristotle's first insight was that the structure of these categorical propositions isn't tied to their content. We can forget about frogs, philosophers, and patentable inventions. We can represent the structures themselves using just an S for the subject term of the proposition, any subject term, and P for the predicate. With that abstraction, we're looking at four basic types of categorical propositions. No SRP, all SRP, some SRP, some S are not P. That visualization leads to a second one. Aristotle's square of opposition. At the core of Aristotle's logic is a picture of the logical relations between those kinds of propositions. The four types of categorical propositions are on very specific corners of the square. All SRP is up there on the left. No SRP is up here on the right. Some SRP is lower left. Some S are not P is lower right. Across the top of the square are what we call the universal propositions, those that are all or nothing, all SRP or no SRP. Across the bottom are what we call the particular propositions, the ones that are about some S, not all, not none, just some. Some S are P, some S are not P. That's not all. Running down the left side are the positive propositions, all S are, some S are. Running down the right side are the negative propositions, some are not, or none are. That's the setup. Universal positive, upper left, all SRP. Universal negative, upper right, no SRP. Particular positive, lower left, some SRP. Particular negative, lower right, some S are not P. Okay, I'll rattle off a few categorical propositions. As I do so, I want you to mentally position them on the square of opposition. For each one, ask yourself, is this universal positive on the upper left? Universal negative on the upper right? Particular positive on the lower left? Or particular negative on the lower right? All snakes are reptiles. No snakes are reptiles. Some snakes are reptiles. Some snakes are not reptiles. Those positions in order were left to right across the top, then left to right across the bottom. All snakes are reptiles is universal affirmative, upper left. No snakes are reptiles is universal negative, upper right. Some snakes are reptiles, particular positive, lower left. Some snakes are not, particular negative, lower right. I'll give you four more. As you hear them, Drop them into place in your mental square of opposition. Some philosophers are not logicians. No philosophers are logicians. All philosophers are logicians. Some philosophers are logicians. Did you get those? They should have moved counterclockwise from the lower right. With the positions of each type of proposition firmly in your head, you're ready to see the real magic of Aristotle's visualization. First, look at the propositions on the diagonals. Those are contradictories. They can't both be true, and they can't both be false. No matter what S and P are, the propositions on the diagonals will contradict each other. It can't be true that all snakes are reptiles and also true that some aren't. No way, that's a contradiction. It can't be false that no philosophers are logicians, that would mean that some are, and also be false that some philosophers are logicians. That too is a contradiction. Now look at the relationship between top and bottom on the left and top and bottom on the right. All SRP top left, some SRP below it. No SRP top right, some S are not P below it. In each case, the top proposition implies the one below. That means if the top one is true, the bottom one has to be true too. If all tickets are winning tickets, some have to be. That's moving down on the left. If no tickets are winning tickets, some tickets have to not be winning tickets. That's moving down on the right. Now think of it from the bottom to the top on each side, and think in terms of false rather than true. If the bottom one is false on either side, the top one has to be false too. If it's false that some SRP, it must also be false that all SRP. If it's false that some S are not P, it must also be false that no S or P. Here's another way to express that relation. True at the top on either side gives us true at the bottom. That's the direction of implication. False at the bottom on either side gives us false at the top. You can think of that as counterindication. So let's sum up. Across the diagonals, both propositions can't be true and both can't be false. Those are contradictories. Going down the sides, if the top one is true, the bottom one has to be true. Those are implications. If the bottom is false, the top has to be false too. Counterindication. Two other aspects of the square are a bit more obscure. They're called contraries and subcontraries. Consider the propositions across the top. Those can't both be true. It can't be both true that all tickets are winning tickets and no tickets are winning tickets. But they could both be false. How? Well, if some are winning tickets and some aren't. The propositions across the top are called contraries. Both can't be true, but both could be false. The propositions across the bottom have exactly the opposite relationship. Both could be true, but they can't both be false. Let me give you an example. Both of these propositions could be true. Some men are professional football players, some men are not. But both couldn't be false. This is a little harder to see, but it's there. Suppose it's false that some men are football players. That must mean that no men are football players. As long as we have men, it follows that some men are not football players. But that gives us true on the lower right. Both lowers can't be false, but both could be true. Those are called subcontraries. How does all this help in everyday reasoning? If you visualize propositions as located on the square of opposition, you will instantly know the logical relations between them. I'm going to give you two propositions. I want you to tell me their logical relationship. Are they contradictory? Does one imply the other? Are they contraries? Start with these two. All bivalves are polisopods. Some bivalves are not polisopods. Drop them onto the square. They're diagonals. That's all you need to know. Contradictories, can't both be true, can't both be false. You don't have to know anything at all about polisopods or bivalves. From their form alone, the square of opposition tells you they're contradictories. How about these? All legal drivers are insured. Some legal drivers are insured. What's their relationship? We're going down the left-hand side of the square, so the first one implies the second one. If the first one is true, the second one has to be true too. If the second one is false, the first one has to be false too. One more. No absentee votes are counted. All absentee votes are counted. What's their relationship? Those are contraries. Both couldn't be true, but they could both be false. You can imagine Aristotle drawing his vision with a stick in the sand of Athens. My guess is that he was amazed. My guess is that he was convinced he was looking at the logical structure of the universe. Laid out in the square of opposition are all the relations between our four types of categorical propositions: universal propositions, particular, positive, negative, contradictions, implications, contraries, and subcontraries. It's still a powerful image. I don't expect you to have gotten all the details in this brief presentation, but take some time to study the square of opposition, and you'll have the logic of Aristotle at your fingertips. I'll let some of that logic sink in while I fill in a little background history, just for fun. Aristotle's logic appears in a series of works collected as the Organon, or the Instrument, a set of lectures that outlined instruments for thought. Aristotle's Organon was the first philosophical toolkit lecture series. The Organon starts with the categories, just as we started with concepts. It includes the prior analytics, the posterior analytics, on interpretation. Those are the sacred texts of logic. Earlier in the lecture, I asked you to visualize the real man that was Aristotle, and the real texts that were those lecture notes written in Greek on papyrus. What happened to the originals? Can you see them in the Athens Museum? No, the history of Aristotle's texts is much stranger than that. We said that the intellectual genealogy went from Socrates to Plato to Aristotle. It actually goes one step farther, to one of Aristotle's students. Aristotle's father had been court physician to the court of Macedonia. Aristotle eventually became tutor to the son of Philip of Macedonia. The boy's name was Alexander, and he went on to conquer most of the known world. You know him as Alexander the Great. After Plato died, Aristotle founded his own school, the Lyceum. Funding came from his patron and former student, Alexander the Great. Aristotle died in 322 BC at the age of 62. The ancient biographer Diogenes Laertes tells us the text of his will. All will be well, but in case anything should happen, Aristotle has made these dispositions. In the will, he names his executor and makes provision for his second wife and his two children. He asks that he be buried next to his first wife in accordance with her wishes. His books were undoubtedly the core of the Lyceum's library. Those he leaves to Theophrastus, his successor as director. It's Theophrastus who takes charge of the Aristotelian manuscripts. We also have a transcript of Theophrastus's will. The important line is, "I leave all my books to Neleus." Neleus had known Aristotle. In fact, he was by that time probably the only living man who had been taught by Aristotle. It was natural for Theophrastus to assume that Neleus would become the new director of the Lyceum. But the scholars of the Lyceum didn't choose Neleus. They chose Strato. Neleus left in a tiff and took Aristotle's manuscripts with him. When Epicurus came to Athens as a 20-year-old, all the Aristotle he could get were the popular works, the exoteric works. Those have now disappeared entirely. The Aristotelian manuscripts? Neleus took them to his hometown, where they were buried in a cellar and passed down through his family for generations. The library at Alexandria tried to get them, but failed. If they had succeeded, Aristotle's logic might have disappeared when the library burned. Generations later, one of Neleus's descendants dug up the scrolls and sold them to a book collector named Apellicon of Teos. He took them to Athens, but they were decayed and full of holes by that time. But Apellicon thought of himself as a philosopher, as well as a book collector. So he filled in the holes. That's been a problem for scholars ever since. Some of what we're reading may be Aristotle. Some of what we're reading may be Apellicon of Teos. In 86 BC, the Roman general Sulla sacked Athens. Apellicon was one of the first to fall, and Sulla took his library back to Rome. There, after dinner, he took pride in letting visitors see and copy out portions of Aristotle's manuscripts. Sulla bequeathed the original Aristotelian manuscripts to his son Faustus. Faustus was a spendthrift and eventually had to sell off everything he owned. It's at that point that the original manuscripts disappear from history. What we have are copies of copies, probably of manuscripts seen at Sulla's after dinner, with holes of decay filled in by Apellicon of Teos. Okay, let's get back to the logic. What the square of opposition gives us is a visualization for all of these: contradictions, contraries, implications, counterindications. Here's why those relations are important. Those are the logical relations fundamental for rationality in all the ways that rationality is important to us. Think of debate, an attempt to decide between conflicting views. That's what political debate is all about. That's what legal argument in a court of law is all about. That's what negotiation is all about. And when do two views conflict? Precisely when they are either contradictories or contraries. Think of the kinds of calculations we do in mathematics and engineering. Think also of the predictions we make on the basis of scientific theory. Those are all about implication. If this mathematical fact is true, so is this one. Given this scientific theory and given these initial conditions, this is what we can expect to happen. Think finally of how we test scientific theories. A theory predicts an eclipse at 12:30, but it doesn't happen. That theory has to be wrong. That's disconfirmation, crucial to all scientific rationality, and it follows the structure of counterindication. Rational debate, calculation and prediction, empirical tests and disconfirmation, the logical relations crucial to those are precisely those laid out in Aristotle's Square of Opposition. The visualizations we've developed also allow us to understand the logic of certain ways of transforming propositions. We'll be talking about transforming a proposition into its converse or its contrapositive. For certain types of propositions, on specific corners of the square, these transforms give us immediate inferences. If the original sentence is true, so is its transform. But it'll be important to remember what positions on the square these work for. Let's start with the converse. That transform holds for propositions in the upper right and the lower left. The universal negative, no SRP, and the particular positive, some SRP. If one of those is true, it'll still be true when you switch subject and predicate. If it's true, it'll still be true. If it's false, it'll still be false. But remember, that holds only for upper right and lower left. So take the proposition, no fish or reptiles, universal negative, upper right. And if no fish or reptiles, no reptiles or fish. Some experimental failures or scientific breakthroughs. Switch subject and predicate and you get some scientific breakthroughs are experimental failures. If one's true, the other is. If one's false, the other is too. An immediate inference. If some cleaning products are poisons, it follows immediately that some poisons are cleaning products. If some primates are philosophers, it follows immediately that some philosophers are primates. If you go back to our Venn diagrams, you can see exactly why converse works for the upper right and lower left. Look at our Venn diagrams for those. Both diagrams are symmetrical. One says there is something in the overlap area and puts an X there. One says there's nothing in the overlap area and blanks it out. But the overlap is the same, whether you think of it as the overlap between S and P or the overlap between P and S. It doesn't matter which one you make the subject term and which one you make the predicate term. What the proposition says is the same in each case. They're equivalent. The other forms of proposition, the upper left and lower right, are not symmetrical. The converse is not guaranteed to hold for those. But there is a transform that does hold for those. It's called the contrapositive. In order to understand it, we have to introduce one more concept, the complement. Let's take the category senators. The complement is a category of everyone who isn't a senator, the non-senators. Or consider all the poisonous substances, and consider the substances that aren't poisonous. Those two categories are complements. You take the two categories in a proposition, and you use their complements in order to arrive at the contrapositive. While leaving everything else the same, you switch subject and predicate, but this time you also replace each by their complement. If you're dealing with the upper left or lower right corners of the square, that again gives you an equivalent proposition. That again gives you an immediate inference. All senators are congressmen. Switch subject and predicate and replace them with their complements. All non-congressmen are non-senators. All people are primates. Switch subject and predicate and replace them with their complements. All non-primates are something other than people. The inference is immediate and guaranteed. But try this on your friends, and you'll see how difficult it is for people. Next time they say something like, "All the widgets are defective," say, "Do you mean that everything that isn't defective isn't a widget?" The logical inference is immediate, but you'll be amazed how long it takes them to process it. Contrapositive works for the lower right, too, but this does get a little tangled. If some liquids are not flammable, some non-flammable things are liquids. I canceled a couple of double negatives there. In summary, then, for upper right and lower left, the converse gives you an immediate inference. You can just switch subject and predicate. Converse isn't guaranteed for the other two. For upper left and lower right, the contrapositive gives you an immediate inference. You can switch subject and predicate and replace each by its complement. Contrapositive isn't guaranteed for the other two. Let me try you on these. These are immediate inferences. With a square of opposition clearly in mind, you should be able to give me these answers even without thinking very hard. Everyone on the committee supports the measure. Does that mean that everyone who doesn't support the measure isn't on the committee? Yes, immediate inference. That's the contraposition of the upper left corner, and that guarantees equivalence. Some registered voters support the measure. Does that mean that some people who support the measure are registered voters? Yes, immediate inference. That's the converse of the lower left. Equivalence guaranteed. Some registered voters support the measure. Does that mean that some who do not support the measure are not registered voters? No. That's a contrapositive transform, but in this case it was applied to the lower left. No guarantee. That might be false. Contrapositive is only guaranteed for upper left and lower right. What I hope you'll take away from this lecture isn't so much a conclusion as an image. I want you to take away that image at the core of Aristotle's logic, the square of opposition. Picture the categorical propositions laid out that way. Universal across the top, particular across the bottom, positive to the left side, negative to the right. With that image, the core logical relations are laid out before you. Contradictions on the diagonals. They can't both be true, they can't both be false. Implications down the sides. If the first is true, the second is. That gives us counterindications, too. If the second is false, so is the first. Contraries across the top. Contradictions' weaker sister. They couldn't both be true, but they could both be false. Subcontraries across the bottom. They couldn't both be false, but they could both be true. We threw in converses and contrapositives for good measure. We'll return to Aristotle in the next lecture. With a break for creative thinking, we'll then take our logic well beyond him.